All right, good morning, everyone. Sorry for starting late here. I think we were all stuck at the same light out there. So I know at least a good number of us were because we were on a text chain all there together. So there's a quorum present. First item on the agenda for the day is adoption of the minutes. Who's been here the longest? Representative Dodseth, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have. I make a motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you very much. Representative Dodseth makes a motion to approve the minutes for Thursday, March 11, 2026. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. First on the agenda is a bill that we have heard before, so we will be hearing about the DE amendment, and so I will move the Senate file 1750 before us. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bonner. I will move your bill before the committee with its intent to be sent to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. I also understand that you have an amendment. There is a DE-12 author's amendment, and I have heard you may have an amendment to the amendment.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'll maybe give you a high-level overview of the DE-12 and then discuss an oral amendment. Our staff is amazing, but unfortunately, they missed something, so we're going to maybe do an oral amendment to live up to our agreements. The DE-12 before you is, there's a ton of small technical corrections. Those were on the advice of the Minnesota Bar Association, so we took those. And then I'll just briefly kind of give you sort of the highlights of what else you will expect in there. We did remove Section 1. There was only one change at the time in that section, and that language we found a more elegant solution to move it elsewhere, so it's no longer needed. In the new Section 1, we updated the definition of property manager, again, based on the Minnesota Bar Association. We took out a couple of words that were already included in the definition elsewhere in the document. Section 2, we did a quick clarify of that the termination should be by written agreement of the unit owners. And on 8/26, we did a quick clarify of one of the words. In Section 4, powers and duties, we did do some reordering of items just to make sure they flowed better and that they were a little bit more logical. We did add that the board's ability to increase fines at a future date with the consent of the unit owners. And then under the rights to contest a fine or assessment, we added some additional limiting language that provides a 30-day limit to contest something and also provides a 30-day written notice of the resolution of that decision, so folks have it available to them. It also removes the right to cure language, which was a little bit vague, and so we took that out. We refined the section on the schedules of fines and fees to the unit owners for greater transparency. And then on 23.8, we clarified the renewable contracts to stipulate that 12 months after the declarant period, the contract must terminate. And it allows newly elected board to have the contract of their preference. And finally, it has the ability for future contracts must have the option of a three-month termination with or without cause if the parties wish to part ways. And then we have a plethora, as I mentioned, of technical fixes and so forth from the Minnesota Bar, including two minor typos that were fixed. We did, I will skip over that one for right now, because that will be in the oral amendment. Section 11 on legal fees notice, we added a notification to unit owners if there's a question or an inquiry that may need referral to legal counsel, that they may incur a charge, but that the notice of that should be provided at no charge. There are also three disclosure pieces added in under the bylaws, disclosure and resale regarding master insurance policies, and making it clear the need for an independent HO6 supplemental policy to cover unit owner's portion of a deductible resulting from an insurance claim. We just want to make sure that unit owners are well aware of their responsibilities. That is the DE-12, and then I will circle back on 36.25, the dispute resolution section. We've actually found a better solution and moved some of that content elsewhere in the document, so we are deleting that section. That will be the oral amendment.
Ms. Pompeo, could you please take that amendment for us?
Sure. Chair and members, the oral amendment will be page 36, delete section 10.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to that oral amendment? Seeing none, we will vote on the oral amendment to the DE 12. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. To the DE 12 as amended. Any further discussion to that?
You know, this has been a long, winding road over about 2 years' time through a work group, open listening sessions with communities, and working with stakeholders quite closely. What you see here, these final tweaks are, again, just some cleanup and a few agreements that were struck with stakeholders to get it in the best possible shape and prepared for judiciary.
Thank you. With that, we will move to member discussion. Is there any discussion to the the DE 12? Representative Dotson.
Representative, can you just speak a little bit about the dispute resolution process, how that's been resolved with the new changes here, please?
Representative Bonner.
So there is in statute some portions that actually do have a pathway for dispute resolution. This also includes some clarifications in certain sections. In particular, if you wish to dispute a fine, for example, we did provide a more detailed outline of that specific part, allowing them to do so, but they setting those limits again on 30 days in order to actually dispute something, so it's not indefinite. We don't want to put extra burden on the boards. And of course, that they would give a written notice of that decision to the individuals within 30 days of that decision. So it's very clear and crisp and clean in terms of what the board's responsibility is and setting expectations for the actual homeowner. There are other dispute resolution pieces in the bill that already are included, like the right to a hearing and be seen before the board, the right to have an attorney present. All of those types of things already are in the bill in other places and exist currently. So we just wanted to make sure that we weren't duplicating efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, we will adopt the DE 12 then to Senate File 1750.
As amended.
We're adopting the amendment.
But as amended.
As amended. You're right. All right. We will adopt the DE 12 as amended to Senate File 1750. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Now to Senate File 1750 as amended. Any final thoughts, discussion, questions? Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bonner, thank you. I know that this has been something that you have been working on, as you mentioned in your comments this morning, for a few years. And I want to just take just a moment to talk about the history on this. Last year, we were talking about this. I said I didn't think it was ready for prime time and for us to do it. And if we're going to hit that statute, it hasn't been touched in 32 years. We should really make sure that we're doing things that are clear, clean, and understandable for all parties that are involved. And last year, we put the task force together to deal with insurance-related issues. And I think that your bill also now, as amended, reflects some of the things that we discovered in the insurance task force that can be helpful, as well as we established the office of the Ombuds office in the Department of Commerce for CIC-related things. So two good things. This is being the third item. And again, thank you for being patient with that process. And thank you for allowing me to work with you to be able to get it to a level that I think that it becomes a handbook more than anything for the volunteers who are members of an association and own properties in those associations who are going to be on the board of directors. They're novices. They're not attorneys. They're not real estate professionals. They're residents who are working on behalf of all members of that association. And it's very clear now when something happens, what's step A, what's step B, what's step C. And so hopefully that will provide clarification not only for the boards, for the management companies, as well as the residents about how that process is going to work. So again, thank you for your work and your effort on this. And I will certainly be supporting it today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Any further, or seeing no further discussions, any wrap up, Chair, or Chris, Representative Bonner?
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Yes, you know, I think that really this bill sets a solid foundation. We haven't really touched the statute, as you mentioned, in about 32 years. A lot of states across the country are, in fact, starting to say that they need to do some cleanup in their statutes around these issues, specifically because about 80% of all new construction is actually in an HOA. So we've seen an incredible explosion of HOAs, so setting some basic guardrails is really useful, and of course helping all parties to understand what their expectations are and their responsibilities is a good idea. So this bill really falls into three categories. It is really about transparency, best practice, and some consumer protections. So thank you, and I look forward to your support.
Thank you very much. And so with that, seeing no further discussion, I will move Senate File 1750 as amended be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. You are on your way. Next up, I will make my way up for one of our last minute moves here. And,
I'm going to move over. I'm going to slide over. Okay, for our second item of business today, we have House File 3642 before us with the intent to move the bill to the General Register. I understand, Chair Cagle, that you have an amendment to offer.
Thank you, Chair Elkins. So the DE6 is a incorporates some of the definitions from Representative Allen's bill, which we think were more robust. These definitions close a loophole where folks were replacing QR codes on countertops that effectively act as a kiosk, mm-hmm. although it's not a physical ATM-like kiosk. Staggering the effective dates, we wanted to ensure that we create a window for folks to still receive a refund if they happen to be defrauded close to the date of the removal of the machines. And then the existing statute for refunds is 14 days after the 72-hour new customer period. So we use that same formula, 72 hours plus 14 days after the required date of removal that creates the refund window that I talked about. So really specific, I know, but this ensures our seniors still have a path to be made whole should they get scammed right before the bill goes into effect. So just trying to close all those loopholes. And so with that, I'll move the DE6 to House File 3642.
Okay, Chair Cagle moves to adopt the DE6 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. If there's no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. Please present your bill, Chair Cagle.
Thank you. So this is prohibition of virtual crypto kiosks. And so after a lot of discussion with stakeholders, we decided that it would be best to kind of pull crypto kiosks back until we can get a rein on the problem. We saw a recent report from the Attorney General in Iowa who said 98% of transactions at crypto kiosks in their state were tied to scams. 98%, actually over 98%. So, yeah, pretty crazy. And so we really just want to make sure that we get a handle on this problem before it becomes an even larger problem. So with that, I will take any questions. Or
do we have any testifiers?
We
don't. No testifiers, okay.
And I just really wanted to thank as well Representative Perryman and Chair O'Driscoll for really working together with us on this. This is a really good bipartisan bill, and I just really appreciate all the support on it. So.
Okay, discussion. Do members have questions? Chair O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go last if there's others that want to speak, if that's kind of the protocol that we've been following.
Thank you, Chair. Just a brief question. How would it be enforced with the kiosks that are still out that are in place right now?
I believe that they would have...
Oh. Madam Chair?
Thank you. And I might have to phone a friend on this one. Actually, I was going to see if Alex would
think,
come up.
Ms. Pompu might know the answer.
Okay.
Chair and members, the bill has several dates. So it becomes effective, the prohibition is effective, and they cannot operate August 1st, 2026. And then they have until December 31st, 2026 to physically remove the kiosks. The Department of Commerce enforces the virtual currency kiosk statutes, and so they would be in charge of ensuring that that occurs.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Smith, and then...
No, sorry.
Oh, Representative Finke is first. Okay. Oh, I see. Gotcha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Cagle, for your bill. I just want to say that I really appreciate this bill, one, because we need to make sure people aren't getting scammed, but two, because it is a statement, a policy statement that is bipartisan, that says, like, the things we are told are inevitable are not inevitable, right? Like, we make decisions about what happens in the state of Minnesota, and often there are forces telling us that things are already here and we can't stop them and we just need to adapt and regulate. And that's just wrong. We can decide what we want to have in the state of Minnesota, whether it's crypto or AI or data centers. It's our decision what moves forward. These things are not inevitable because corporations and businesses tell us, well, it's too late, just get on board. So this is a small step in that direction, but it really means a lot to me, and I think to a lot of people who are just constantly told, well, it's too late, crypto's here, you need to figure it out. We don't have to do that. We can make those decisions. Thank you.
Actually, I think this is a pretty big step. Representative Perryman.
I want to thank you, Representative Cagle, Chair Cagle, for bringing this and letting me step in your world with this and work together on it. And I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you from the law enforcement in St. Cloud that came here originally to testify. So thank you from my community to your work on this. Thank you.
I see no other hands raised. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to be a part of the Mutual Admiration Society this morning as well. But I think that to Representative Finke's point, this is a good bipartisan piece of legislation. This is how bills need to be done in the way we've been doing it in this committee, the one that we had with Representative Bonner before. We had good, solid bipartisan support, and it's going to be good legislation. Same with this. Mm-hmm. Since we have the bill up originally, Representative Allen had been contacted. He was working on something. He was also contacted by his local law enforcement officials about scams that were going on in his community. Representative Perryman had some folks that were here. I have, since this has been brought forward, had local law enforcement in my district come to me and say, the best thing to do is to ban this right now because it's running rampant. Mm-hmm. This does not mean, for the record, that people cannot purchase crypto. It just means they can't go to these kiosks and engage in those types of situations. They certainly can establish an account online and purchase and trade and do whatever they want to do with crypto in that environment, which is a safer environment than going up to a kiosk and being scammed in the situation. So again, you will have my support on this bill, and I encourage our members to support as well. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, wrap up.
Thank you very much. I also just want to give credit to Alex Wheeler, our CLA here. He's been busting his butt on this bill for a long time. He's been working on it actually since now Senator Hemmingsen Yeager initially worked on it. And so all these people around us really make us look smart. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to make sure that the credit goes to where it's due. And so thanks, Alex, for working on all this.
Okay.
And with that, I will move House File 3642 as amended to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? You're on your way to the General Register.
And just want to say one last hi to Alex's mom watching.
She'll love that.
Well, look, he just got a pass.
Next up on the agenda for the day is House File 3904, and I will find my notes as Representative Hansen makes her way up. All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen. If you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to move that, and they also have an A1 amendment.
And the motion, the bill is intended to be laid over?
Yes, I believe that is the motion. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just wanted to check. All right. The A1 amendment, would you like to explain the A1 amendment for us, please?
The A1 amendment just gets this bill in the shape that I would like, and it's a reflection of the latest negotiations, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Hansen, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. House File 3904 is really important. Clinical trainees are the backbone of our mental health and chemical dependency treatment workforce. Under Chapter 245I, these are graduate-level professionals who provide care while being mentored and supervised by experienced, licensed supervisors. Think of them like medical residents. You wouldn't have a hospital without residents, and you certainly wouldn't have a future generation of doctors without them. In mental health and the substance use disorder treatment field, being a trainee is the only pathway to becoming a licensed independent professional. Until recently, there was no debate about this. Trainees have always provided care to tens of thousands of Minnesotans, and insurance providers have always reimbursed for that care. It has always been the historical norm. But recently, we hit an unexpected and arbitrary roadblock. A major commercial payer decided, without legislative authorization, that care delivered by clinical trainees will no longer be eligible for the same reimbursement under its commercial plans without a specific contract addendum. And while some providers hold this older authorization, these permits are currently unavailable to new applicants, which is very problematic. This wasn't a policy shift based on quality of care. It was a bureaucratic decision that effectively pulled the rug out from under our clinics and our students. If we leave things as they are, our mental health system starts to fall apart, and it hits rural Minnesota the hardest. For example, students who grew up in greater Minnesota often want to go back home to practice where their services and expertise are desperately needed. But they can't go home if the local supervisors can't afford to take them under their wing. When reimbursement stops or reduces, the mental health and substance use disorder treatment health pipeline to our rural communities and statewide dries up. We cannot stand by and watch these already strapped communities be hampered by a decision that was never intended. This bill is a simple, common sense fix. It doesn't create a new radical mandate. It simply codifies the historical norm and our expectations. It ensures that commercial plans follow the same consistent standards as every other payer in the state. It provides certainty for the clients who need the care, the payers who need a stable network, and the providers who are trying to train the next generation and provide services. I want to be really clear that this bill does not mandate any coverage of new benefits. It simply clarifies that plans cannot preclude certain qualified practitioners from providing services that are covered within their scope of practice. This bill is not seeking to address any challenges providers are having with Medicaid or fee-for-service or managed care. Rather, this is a direct response to Optum's statement that they will no longer recognize services provided by clinical trainees. The role of a clinical trainee in various Medicaid-covered services is spelled out clearly in 256B, with various services covered under 256B.0625 and .0671. We all know that when people can access mental health and substance use disorder care, our entire society does better. Your support today isn't just about a billing code or backing some newfangled mandate. It's about restoring the crucial workforce pipeline and keeping our commitment to Minnesota's mental health and overall well-being. Thank you, Chair. I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. Notes. All right. Is there any testifiers that are that would like to speak to the bill? Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chair Cagle, Co-Chair O'Driscoll, and members of the Commerce and Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Julie Shortall, and I serve as the CEO of St. David's Developmental and Therapeutic Services. I'm speaking today on behalf of Aspire Minnesota and our wider mental health field. We are grateful to Representative Hansen for leading House File 3904 and to this committee for hearing this important legislation. St. David's, my organization, offers a continuum of mental health interventions, including assessment, school-based therapies, parent-child outpatient services, and intensive day treatment, serving over 8,000 children and caregivers in 2025 alone. The children we serve are often working hard to understand their own regulatory systems or cope with very difficult experiences they've had early in life. Many have been removed from other settings due to behavioral needs, or they've gone without services altogether. Of the 200 mental health clinicians St. David's employs, 42 are clinical trainees. Minnesota's strong state requirements and the way organizations like ours implement them ensure that trainees receive effective oversight from licensed supervisors while gaining early career experiences that they need to grow into strong clinicians. Our staff receive weekly supervision, individual and group, extensive continuing education, and ready access to on-site consultation. The mental health system relies on clinical trainees to deliver high-quality care. Currently, all payers reimburse for services provided by clinical trainees. Recently, one of our payers, as you've heard, has indicated they will no longer do so, which is why House File 3904 is essential. This puts agencies like St. David's in an impossible position. Either leave children without services, or providers cannot be reimbursed for the services we provide today. Today, 600 children are waiting for an opening in one of our mental health programs. So neither option is acceptable, and both would undermine the mental health system we are all working hard to strengthen. If you no longer are able to employ or bill for services provided by master's level clinical trainees, our capacity would shrink dramatically in the system in a time when we are already strained and families are already under distress. Wait times will grow across the state. Children and caregivers will remain in crisis at the very moment that they need our support. Thank you for your time and for your commitment to Minnesota's children and families.
Thank you. Are there any other members willing, or any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we can move to member discussion. Representative Katizi-Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill forward. I am curious, in your conversations with advocates and stakeholders, has there been any discussion about a domino effect? This is one of the largest providers in the state that's taking this step. And unless I'm misremembering, they are part of a for-profit insurance provider. So I'm just curious what the interplay may be with other not-for-profit clinics or providers across the state trying to, you know, maybe follow suit and what that could lead to.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that question, Representative Katizi-Watoon. Right now, I don't have any direct information about that, but what I can share is after 17 years of experience in corporate healthcare and for-profit health insurance, it is pretty common to see this have a domino effect. I can't say that on this issue specifically right now, but we've seen this in a lot of things, whether it was different radiographs that are covered or different pre-authorizations that were required. It does sometimes have a sweeping industry effect, and so getting ahead of this and making sure we reiterate what our intent is as the legislature, I think, is really important.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Katizi-Watoon? Thank you. I do have a couple questions, and so I would ask that the department, and actually, Mr. Andreessen, if you could come up as well, too, please. Thank you. Just a quick question for you, Mr. Andreessen, if you could just identify yourself for the record. Where do the health plans stand on this?
Madam Chair, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, representing nonprofit insurers in the state. We're neutral on the bill. Our read of it is that it mirrors current practice for us in the fully insured market. I will note that it sounds like our read of the bill, or at least what's been mentioned by the proponents, is that this is a self-insured situation with an employer here in the state. So we don't know if this bill would change their practices.
Thank you. And then to Mr. Smith,
Can you kind of speak to some of the 62J, if this is considered a mandate or not?
Chair Cagle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sam Smith with the Department of Commerce, and in our analysis, this legislation does not alter what services are covered by a plan, and any adjustments in provider reimbursement would not fall under the 62J requirements.
Thank you. Are there any other member questions to this? Seeing none, I will release the testifiers. And then any final thoughts to the bill, Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair. And I will just say that I agreed with the choice to lay this over, but I do think this is something we should take pretty seriously, particularly for folks in rural Minnesota, to make sure that we're not stifling that workforce pipeline. My career here at the legislature, I've spent a lot of time working really hard to make sure we can bolster that pipeline, because without mental health practitioners, substance use disorder providers, folks who can treat alcoholism, you know, our whole society suffers. And so I've worked really hard to make sure we can bulk that up. We've made really great strides, good investments, and good policy changes around some of our licensing practices, too. So this is one step that we can just continue to support those supervisees. And so I would encourage, if the committee is willing to, after some more discussion, be willing to send this to a general register and another vote after folks have talked about it. I'm happy to clarify again that this is not a new mandate. I know that's a concern. But again, this is a historical norm that we've always done, and we're really just trying to codify that and make sure that people continue to have access. If you have mental health practitioners in your community, I would suggest speaking with them and talking to them about how this has affected them, because those practitioners really have a first inside look on how this is impacting their day-to-day practice and their ability to help continue to feed that pipeline.
Thank you, and sorry to kind of Representative Van Binsbergen.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I know I'm kind of going late and you're finishing your comments. Yeah. You know, you say it's, I just wanted to get something in your final comments. Mm-hmm. You say it's not a new mandate. Mm-hmm. How many trainees is this affect?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I'd have to get a call, phone a friend to maybe get an exact number for you, but it would, in theory, affect any trainee who is under a supervisor that is seeing, if that trainee is seeing a patient who's covered under the plan that has chosen to do this. And so that number can be in flux, obviously, depending on how many people are pursuing care. But any trainee who would be seeing them would, you know, potentially be subject to this.
So Representative Van Binsbergen.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. So what's kind of typically the difference in pay rate between a trainee and a licensed provider?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I'm looking to see if I want to phone a friend on the exact amount, but I actually was just on the phone with a friend of mine who is a therapist, and she was digging through her paperwork to try to see if she had gotten a different fee schedule for these things. And when she was a trainee, they actually didn't even provide her one, which is a bill that I would like to address separately from this issue, but I do think that payers should make sure that all of their providers get access to those fee reimbursements. But we'll see if our friends at Aspire can give you a more specific answer on the exact difference in the pay rate.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Co-Chair Kegel, members. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Aspire Minnesota. We're a statewide association of child and family serving organizations. And so as it relates to the compensation of a clinical trainee.
Can you pull the mic closer, please?
Sorry. Apologies. As it relates to the compensation, that is fundamentally an organizational question, just like when someone is hired within any organizational structure, how they would be then compensated. And typically, because they would be new entering members of the workforce, they'd be compensated at the entering level of compensation. And part of what has been the status quo for service is that we compensate, as has been increasingly the requirement within our health and human services environment, is that we compensate for a code at the level of the code that has been reimbursed for. So we want to compensate for the same thing at the same rate.
Representative Van Binsbergen?
I'm just concerned about, again, this is a passionate issue for me, healthcare costs, mm-hmm. just in general. Got a lot of, my folks are paying these premiums. I'm hearing about this every day. And you say it's not a new mandate to health insurance companies. I just, it is a concern to me, because obviously when we pass something down, the insurance companies pass it down to the people that are paying the bill. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. And thank you for that question. I agree with you that that would be a concern, except for this is how we've always been doing it. And so that's already been baked into the actuarial analyses of these, and suddenly it changed. And so I would be surprised if the actuarial analysis has even caught up to this yet, frankly. If they have, I would be willing to, you know, maybe ask our on-site friend who has an actuary in the family. But I would, that would be a question I would ask my actuary friends, is have they even caught up with this yet? Because this decision has come down. And again, I think the bigger problem is that it hasn't been happening at other carriers. It's just this one who has decided to kind of play with the market and see if we will stand for it. And I think we have a chance to say we want our communities to be supported, to have access to mental health care, because I think that's a nonpartisan issue. I think we all have said we care about that quite a bit, and that we want to continue to feed this pipeline, because without enough mental health practitioners and substance use disorder providers, we're really going to end up in a tougher spot than we are in every facet of society, from health to education to criminal activities and more. Like, this is a real important thread that I think we should take seriously, and that's why I'm really pushing on this conversation about it not being a mandate, because again, it's already been the norm for so long, and we don't want this to cascade and have a domino effect on others. And I would invite any actuary who's listening, possibly, to reach out to me and let me know if they have caught up to this or not yet.
Representative Van, oh, thank you. And you know, I served, I think, 5 years on the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. One thing that we heard continuously through that process is the workforce shortage.
Yeah.
And so when I think about this, I really think about the ripple effect that it will have in the workforce. If we are not able to train our mental health and, you know, DACs through the system, then we're not going to have those people there in the end to actually do the work that needs to be done. And it's a really tough process. I know, you know, gone through rehab and all of that with my brother. It's been, you know, those folks saved his life. And so that's the work that they're doing. They're saving people's lives and making sure that they can contribute to society and be a part of our world. You know, and so as much as it is a passion to keep health costs down, I think, you know, we need to keep people alive and make sure that they're living healthy, sober lives if that's what they need. Mm-hmm. And so I really hope that we can move this bill forward in the future, because we do not want to deplete our workforce on that mental health aspect, because we know the need is great and only growing bigger. So, you know, making sure we have that workforce, I think, is really key. So thank you very much for this bill. Any final thoughts, Representative Driscoll, Chair, or Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again for the good discussion. I invite anyone to chat with me about this. If you have any further questions, I'm happy to talk about it. I just want to highlight that our testifier who was up here before mentioned that 42 out of 200 practitioners were trainees. That's 20% of their staff. And so when we think about 20% of the staff potentially not being able to be reimbursed for services for a certain subset of members insured by one particular plan, you know, that is really going to have big consequences when said plan is such a big company and is providing such such a large amount of the coverage for folks. So please take a thought about this, and I would love to see this come back up and see if we can get this to the General Register. It seems like it could potentially be a great bipartisan bill to get off the floor to really, really directly answer Minnesotans' calls for more access to mental health care around the state. Thank you.
Thank you, and with that, I will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. And I will be switching chairs once again for the fun stuff.
Okay, Chair Cagle, for our fourth item of business today, we have House File 4250 before us with the intent to refer the bill to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. So, Chair Cagle, would you like to introduce your bill?
Yes, so thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So this is the Stop Making Fun Too Expensive bill.
And so this kind of came from a conversation I was having with one of my good friends. We went, she was talking about a band she wanted to see, and I had never heard of them. They were playing at the 7th Street entry, and so we went online to find tickets, and the cheapest price we could find was $231. And so we decided not to go. And luckily enough, I was able to get tickets at a later date and found out that the ticket, the face value of that ticket was $18. So that's kind of what we're dealing with here. And so this morning when I was getting ready, I was thinking about all the concerts I'd been to and thinking about my first concert was New Kids on the Block at Harriet Island. And my parents brought me and one of my good friends, and they actually rented us a limo, and we pretended that we were celebrities going down to the concert. It was so much fun. I just remember cracking the window and yelling, "Hey, Joey, pass me a Coke," to see if we could get people to think that we were actually the Backstreet Boys. So anyway, and just those fun memories that I have, saving up my allowance money to go down to Rainbow and sit in line to get Smashing Pumpkin tickets when I was in seventh grade. And, you know, then as a senior in high school, me and a bunch of my friends all got tickets to both NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys. I guess you guys are starting to learn a little bit about my musical taste. And then, you know, one of the most recent concerts I went to, well, not one of the most recent, but one of the ones that sticks in my mind, of course, was Taylor Swift and how incredible of a concert that was and just how much joy it brought to everybody. And it was kind of at that perfect time, too, where we were all starting to come back from COVID and the streets in Minneapolis were alive again. And, you know, and I just think about how events like that bring community together. And that's something that we are desperately missing right now. We are all so disconnected from each other. And, you know, these are the kinds of events that bring folks together. You can make new friends. You can dance next to a stranger. You know, it's fun, and so we want to make sure that, you know, all Minnesotans deserve to go out and have a little fun. And so that's kind of just what this bill is about. What I will go over kind of the bill in general. So it really goes to beef up the 1989 Taylor Swift bill. And so we're adding some price transparency. So we're mandating that the all-in pricing is disclosed at the initial listing. So it missing fees. It also has a disclosure requirement, and so it identifies the ticket as a resale, and then identifies if it's a seller or broker and any kind of restrictions, if it's obstructed view, and then so that consumers know exactly what they're buying, because we know that if the key to a fair market is transparency. It also establishes a maximum markup on face value to prevent extreme price gouging and high demands. It modernizes online it clarifies that you cannot sell tickets not yet owned, so speculative tickets or misleading claims about scarcity or urgency. And then misrepresenting availability. And so it targets modern online manipulation. It also would make sure that we could hold marketplaces accountable, and then it makes enforcement more practical and actionable. And so, you know, this is really about transparency in the market and making sure that we know exactly what we're getting. And right now we have a marketplace that's really tilted towards, you know, people who have the information. And we are not the people who have the information. So with that, I will leave it over to my testifiers.
Can the testifiers who are with you introduce themselves for the record, please?
Certainly. My name's Bill Childs.
Adriana Korch Bruce.
Okay.
And I think I'm going first. So okay. Hi, I'm Bill Childs. I use he, him pronouns. I live in St. Paul. I'm an attorney and I'm an adjunct law professor over at the university. I've also done a syndicated children's music radio show for a weirdly long time. On a record label in connection with that, raised over $250,000 for It Gets Better, Girls Inc., and the Haitian People Support Project. My comments are on my own behalf only, not on behalf of my firm or my clients. We moved back to Minnesota in June of 2020 from Austin, Texas. Since then, since things reopened, I went to the entry to see the suburbs. It was the first show back. I've averaged about 54 concerts a year, most of them in venues from 100 to 1,500 capacity, so mostly First Avenue venues. My friends are very familiar with one of my common refrains: live music remains undefeated, for a lot of the reasons that Co-Chair Cagle said. I forgot to, by the way, say hello to Vice Chair Elkins, Co-Chair Cagle, Co-Chair Driscoll, and the members of the committee. I can trace my love of live music. We could probably all go around and talk about the first show, but the first show that really made me fall in love with live music was my very first show at First Avenue, seeing the Suburbs' purported farewell show back in 1987. That did not stick. As I mentioned, I've seen them dozens of times since then. Getting out to see so many bands is really important to me personally, for a lot of the reasons that you've already heard. I think it's important for people's mental health, and a thriving and sustainable live music scene is also incredibly important for our cities and our restaurants and our art scenes more generally. I glanced on TickPick, which is a site that sort of pulls together a bunch of the secondary market pricing when I was writing this testimony. I'm going to go see the band Wednesday, that's the name of the band, on Thursday next week at First Avenue. The secondary market tickets for that are a full $100 more than the list price. Eric Hutchinson, the Turf Club, is listed at $63, face value is $38. Early this year, the Melismatics opened their annual tribute to the legendary Replacements at the Turf Club in the mighty midway of St. Paul. Tickets, face value tickets, were $25. My son was unexpectedly home, interested in going. I looked online. They were for sale for twice that much, $50. So he didn't go. Great show. We should want young people to be going to shows like that. Sometimes I end up overpaying, and it is frustrating to know that the difference in price is going to somebody who did nothing to make my experience better. They didn't make the music. They didn't make the venue. They didn't serve the drinks. They didn't do anything other than engage in arbitrage. They just figured out how to inject themselves into the stream of commerce. More often, if I don't get tickets in the primary market for a show I want to go to, I just throw my hands up and give up, like we heard before. One of the reasons I've done this radio show for kids for as weirdly long as I have, it's been over 20 years, is that I want there to be future generations of music nerds and radio nerds, people who get out and support the arts and the food and the hospitality industry more generally. I mentioned my son earlier. He's in his early 20s, I guess mid-20s now. I'm old. He works as a nature educator up north. He also composes and records and performs doom metal on his bass clarinet. He goes out to see a lot of music when he's back in the cities, but he gets priced out of a lot of shows because he tends to be back on short notice. So he doesn't buy tickets right when they go on sale, and so who he ends up having to consider buying them from are the people that I talked about, who are not making his life or the shows any better. It's not good for a sustainable music scene. That's all on top of the outright fraud that often takes place, including with the secondary markets, who are here to tell you that they're great. I've been at multiple events in the past couple of years where friends had bought tickets through legitimate sources, including those who have submitted testimony here today, and found out that they did not, in fact, have legitimate tickets. They get a refund. They don't get to see the show. A refund does not fix that. That's not good for the scene either. It's going to make people give up on going out. I agree that the resale of tickets should be allowed. I don't think this bill does anything to ban that. Just as an example, my wife broke her arm last month, so we've been selling tickets to shows that we can't go to, been selling them at face value. Being able to do that is a different thing than robots grabbing huge quantities of tickets and reselling them at far greater prices than the artist or the venue wants them to go to, and for excluding the fans that they want to see in the room. Look at the submitted testimony that we've seen from secondary market sellers. They assert that the bill will push the practice to the dark corners of the web. This presumes that those other dark corner actors have the resources and technology to do what they are doing. There's no evidence that that is the case. It also implies that the current companies don't have a problem with fraudulent tickets. Not true. Resellers also claim that they can't figure out what the original values of the tickets was because I guess they can't trust their own customers, the people bringing the tickets to be scalped to them, to tell them the truth about what the price was. Seems to signal a fundamental truth that they know that they're not dealing with honest people, that they and it also provides a solution none of them want to talk about. They can have the sellers indemnify them for any fines they suffer due to misrepresentations about the original face value. They're certainly comfortable putting all sorts of agreements in the click wrap contracts that they have. They could also put that in. Also note that Live Nation has said they support this statute, so perhaps they could tell you if their sibling company Ticketmaster is ready to make the original face value readily available. In short, if all the parade of horribles that you're hearing about were true, they could demonstrate that rather than just hand-waving at scary possibilities. If it turns out the bill is bad, the good news is you can change your mind when it's proven to be that. The evidence that they have that this is unworkable and so impractical as to be impossible is that they point out that Massachusetts got rid of a decades-old statute that they admit was never enforced and that has nothing in common with this bill. It's hard for me to see how that's evidence that this bill is unenforceable or a bad idea. It just says Massachusetts cleaned up an old statute. Representative Finke, and I was very excited that I get to cite her today because I'm a big fan, talked about how bad things are not inevitable simply because people with a lot of money tell you that they are. This is another one of those situations. I encourage your support of this bill, which seems to me to strike an appropriate balance between encouraging an open market and protecting consumers in the live music scene. Help the venues and the artists keep live music undefeated. Thanks for your time this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Vice Chair Elkins, mm-hmm. Co-Chair Driscoll, and committee members. My name is Adriana Korich-Bruce. I'm the Senior Director of Ticketing at First Avenue and have worked tirelessly in live entertainment for 13 years. I am also on the board of Meneva, the local Minnesota chapter of the National Independent Venue Association, representing over 40 venues and promoters across 11 cities, with the mission to preserve and nurture the ecosystem of independent venues and promoters throughout the state. Thank you for taking the time today to learn more about the issue of ticket access, affordability, and fairness, and for your willingness to work with small business owners, fans, and artists alike in hopes to make progress and correct the obvious shortcomings of ticketing and live entertainment and to keep access affordable and real. I've been going to shows, like everyone has stated so far, for as long as I can remember, and my experience getting tickets has been plagued by the discrepancies and inadequacies in regulations since the start. One particular instance stands out. I sat in line at the Dayton's Ticketmaster outlet at the Maplewood Mall in early 2007, waiting to get tickets to Hannah Montana. We got there hours early. The on-sale time came and went. Nothing happened. Nobody moved. About an hour later, a defeated staff member announced that the event was entirely sold out and no one in line would be able to purchase tickets. I was confused, defeated, and upset. My mom even more so. She'd been buying tickets at in-person outlets since the 70s, sometimes camping out, under the guise that if you were the most dedicated fan, if you got there the earliest, that you would be rewarded. Before our eyes, we were seeing the effects of online ticketing change everything. Bots take precedent, scooping up over 80% of the inventory on that tour, immediately listing them for hundreds of dollars over the original price. Now, fandom and artist intent were irrelevant. Venues' ability to control the cost to enter their own property, gone. If you had the deepest wallets and the most connections, you got tickets, and everyday people were left out to dry. State and federal governments have been trying to address the issues. We saw cases brought to court, the Bots Act was passed, outlawing the use of these technologies to mishandle on sales and harm consumers. Many of you supported the passage of House File 1989 in Minnesota in 2024, aimed at banning speculative or fraudulent listings and using venue and artist likeness to deceive fans. And while that has helped, especially in price transparency, it was just the first step. Unless we disincentivize this out-of-control resale industry, the bots and the ticket brokers will continue to outpace us, stripping assets from local communities while small businesses and independent artists fight for the scraps at the bottom. This isn't an issue of a free market. This is a distorted market and an issue of deception and fair practice. They are not contributing to our state's economy. While fans get scammed into paying hundreds of dollars for one event, they have to make unnecessary economic sacrifices elsewhere. They may not be able to attend indie shows in smaller markets. They're less likely to stay at hotels or go out to eat beforehand, in turn affecting the local economies who rely on us, as you'll see reflected in the State of Live report that we'll share next. They buy less merch and less beer at the venues, and the ticket brokers walk away immediately in the green because they have extracted resources from our communities, because they assume no risk for producing the event itself. They are not paying the artist, they are not covering insurance or paying the staff or doing anything to keep lights on at the venues. It's worth noting that this doesn't just affect the largest tours, artists, or venues. This isn't only happening to out-of-touch consumers who struggle with technology. We experience this every day at First Avenue and our affiliated venues, like Turf Club, Fine Line, or the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. Just this past Sunday, I received a distressed message from a local ballet organizer who had a family member spend nearly $1,200 on an event where over 90% of ticket inventory was available on our primary platform.
We have tickets as low as $63 on our website. I have stories upon stories of young fans traveling from out of town, showing up at the doors with fraudulent tickets, heartbroken that they were scammed, and they're angry at the venues and the artists when we're unable to help them since they did not purchase tickets through our channels. These scammers are using AI to scrape our websites daily and create listings for all of our events, and then spending upwards of $1 billion annually on advertising so they will always display above us in Google search results. We must act, and the policy change that will impact consumers, small businesses, and artists with swift, significant influence is to cap the price of resale. We are not aiming to hinder people from changing plans, like Bill mentioned, when they can't get a babysitter or they get sick before a show. We believe that people should be able to resell their tickets. And we understand the process of securing tickets is time-consuming and can be difficult, and there is value associated with that. That's why we are proposing a cap on resale prices at 15% above the original price, inclusive of all fees. The third-party ticket sites will say that doing this will lead to a black market that harms consumers more, when evidence in other countries who have done this does not support this claim. We're already dealing with a black manipulated market, distorted by bots and the immediate listing of resale tickets, unnecessarily marked up in price, regardless of demand. And we have to put an end to it. I've spent my life attending concerts and supporting indie venues and artists, and frankly, I'm very concerned with the sustainability of this industry and this art form if we do not get a handle on the price gouging and the deception that is happening to consumers on the secondary ticket market. I urge you to support House File 4250 to immediately address this issue in an impactful way. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. So the next two testifiers we have will be testifying virtually. First up is Kendall Gilvar, Strategic Communications and Project Manager for the National Independent Venue Association. Are you there, Mr. Gilvar?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, it's Ms. Gilvar.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Vice Chairs Elkin, Co-Chairs Kogel, Co-Chairs O'Driscoll, and committee members. My name is Kendall Gilvar, and I'm here on behalf of the National Independent Venue Association, or NIVA, representing thousands of independently owned venues, festivals, and promoters nationwide, including many here in Minnesota. Today, the independent live industry supports HF 4250. Last year, we conducted an economic impact study of this country's independent stages. And the results in Minnesota were striking. Indie stages in Minnesota contribute $2.4 billion a year to Minnesota's economy and $1.2 billion annually to Minnesota's GDP, which I will say outranks the craft beer industry. While these small businesses are driving significant economic impact in Minnesota, many are struggling financially. We see nationally two-thirds of independent stages were not profitable in 2024. And when we ask why this profitability is such a struggle, as Adriana mentioned, we hear that so many small businesses are going into their own pockets to correct the predatory behavior of ticket resale. Fans are showing up with $400 tickets to a $40 show or with tickets that aren't real. Fans are standing outside crying because they can't get in, and when something goes wrong, the scalper who sold them the resold ticket is not there and likely not even in the state of Minnesota. It's the box office staff left to pick up the pieces and often comping tickets to make things right. As you'll hear from others and you've heard from Adriana, it's time to rein in the system. Resale price caps in the secondary market disincentivize predatory resale behavior. We know as an organization that scalpers share information with one another and target the states where they can operate most easily without any consumer protection consequences. This bill would take Minnesota off of that short list. Enacting a price cap in Minnesota is not controversial. It means aligning ticketing with other marketplaces like the airline or hotel industry, where you can't just resell a ticket for however much money you can make. It means regulating an industry that's operated in the loopholes of legality for decades in this state. And it means joining more than a dozen other states who are actively working to protect their constituents by capping resale specifically, as you know, the map shows. As far as the national ticketing landscape, first and foremost, independent venues have been amongst the loudest voices calling for the breakup of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, right down to this week. At this week's Senate report, which just came out, that makes clear that Live Nation has actually weakened resale protections while profiting from resale price gouging directly. I believe, you know, you have that in your email. Enacting, you know, resale price caps is not just about reining in scalpers. It's also reining in Live Nation as an institution that benefits from scalping. So this would get at both bad actors in the state level. You now have the evidence through that report, through the momentum of other states, and most importantly, through the very, you know, well-versed and intelligent consumers who just testified, that, you know, you can act on this with confidence. You have all the resources and capabilities, and we, you know, hope you'll do that. I want to be candid, lastly, about who's opposing these resale price cap bills. It is the resale platforms and the scalpers who depend on those platforms. Groups specifically, like the Ticket Policy Forum, the Sports Fans Coalition, and of course, companies like StubHub, are backed financially by these marketplaces that make billions of dollars a year off of inflated prices and fees. They're fighting this bill specifically because their model depends on price gouging your constituents, which begs the question, you know, would that be acceptable in any other industry that this committee delegates on? They'll claim, as said, that resale saves consumers money. They'll point to self-selective studies. They'll say that we're aligned with Live Nation and Ticketmaster. All of that is a distraction. They are hoping to distract you and avoid the basic rules that every other online marketplace in the state needs to follow. They've run away without regulation on any sort of practices on the internet. And I urge you to instead listen to the fans and small businesses that actually power Minnesota's economy and return money to the small businesses and fans in the state. I really appreciate your time, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next online testifier is Ian Lee, the Senior Policy Director for the Ticket Policy Forum.
Is he here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming through loud and clear.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Ian Lee, and I represent the Ticket Policy Forum, whose members include leading ticket marketplaces serving millions of fans for secure, transparent, and guaranteed transactions. These are household names like StubHub, SeatGeek, and Vivid Seats, as well as others. While we appreciate the intent behind HF 4250, we respectfully oppose it. Minnesota passed a comprehensive consumer protection framework just 2 years ago, addressing some of the key issues that fans face. Those protections remain in place, and although more work needs to be done to protect fans, this bill risks unintended consequences. First, price caps fail in practice. They do not reduce demand for high demand events. One speaker said earlier he would just not go to shows if they're high priced, but that is not representative of most consumers. Before our marketplaces existed, tickets to high demand shows were still being purchased. They were just purchased from a guy in a parking lot or a back alley by the stadium. Limiting legitimate resale pushes transactions out of regulated marketplaces and into unsafe, unregulated channels like social media groups, informal forums, and Craigslist. These environments lack basic consumer protections. They have no identity verification, no secure payments, no guarantees, and no recourse for situations in which there is fraud. Second, the bill creates a major compliance problem. It assumes resale platforms can verify the original price of tickets. In reality, they cannot. Primary ticketing systems do not share this information, making it impossible to reliably determine or audit compliance. This forces marketplaces into guesswork and creates an unenforceable standard. Third, evidence from other jurisdictions shows that resale restrictions increase fraud. In some markets, ticket scams rose significantly when higher financial losses and a surge in fraud. It's happening right now, and there's a reason that other states have rejected price cap bills this very year, including Washington State, Wisconsin, New Mexico, West Virginia, Tennessee, and Oklahoma. Not one of them has passed a price cap into law. Next, the bill creates an uneven and unfair system. It restricts resale prices, but does nothing to address pricing at the box office, where dynamic pricing can cause tickets to spike dramatically. This limits competition and may actually result in higher prices for consumers. There's a reason that Ticketmaster supports this bill and has submitted testimony to that effect. It would provide the monopoly even more power over the marketplace in Minnesota, and especially given the fact that the DOJ has just caved to Ticketmaster in their federal lawsuit, now is not the time to risk further empowering the monopoly. Maintaining the ability for consumers to comparison shop is important. We have a few cherry-picked examples that other speakers have provided, showing that, you know, in some instances, tickets are more expensive on the secondary market. They are oftentimes also cheaper. For example, for tonight's Jazz at Timberwolves game, we found a ticket for under $100 per seat on Vivid Seats, where the box office price was $150. The same is the case for the Bruce Springsteen show coming up, in which TickPick has tickets offered at $77. And the box office has tickets for $102. Fans can often get better deals on the secondary marketplace, but this bill would make that harder for fans to enjoy. So while we support protecting consumers, this bill risks doing the opposite, driving fans into unsafe channels, increasing fraud, and reducing choice and competition for fans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. The next testifier is David Goodfriend, who I hope is in the room. Okay. And then on deck will be Sean Chapman. Mm-hmm. Mr. Goodfriend, can you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, can you all hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
My name is David Goodfriend. I'm the founder and chairman of Sports Fans Coalition, which since 2009 has fought with big, powerful organizations like the NFL and the broadcast industry, and every now and then we win. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you won't hold it against me that I came in from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, he's the Packers fan.
Oh, my God, you had to let them know. So, yeah, I was born and raised in Madison, Wisconsin, and I almost went to college here, but I stayed in Wisconsin. Sorry about that. Yeah, that's not a good way to start testing. I already submitted written testimony. I thought maybe I'd just make this a little more conversational and make a couple of points. First of all, everything you've heard about the marketplace is true, and it's horrifying. Second of all, it fits into a larger pattern going on in America right now, which is an affordability crisis. Housing, energy, all of it. But it's my belief, as I approach 60 years old, and I've been around this a while, it's my belief that we're missing the root of the problem. We're being distracted. The root of the problem is not limited to the ticketing industry. It's endemic in our entire economy. We live in an oligopoly where four or five firms control the vast majority of market share and can essentially name their price. Airlines, energy, telecommunications, you name it. Here, we have an example of a very adroit monopolist in Live Nation Ticketmaster. And I say adroit because all of the testimony you heard is all the facts are true, all the problems are true, but we're aiming at the wrong culprit. The state of Minnesota, your attorney general, is suing, along with other states, and at least until recently, the federal government, suing Live Nation Ticketmaster for being an illegal monopoly and abusing their market power to the detriment of consumers. Those findings, I think, are rock solid. Your attorney general, to his credit, is not taking the bait that Live Nation has put in front of the Trump administration. Because apparently the Trump administration believes that a tiny monetary payment, sharing of technology that's already substandard, and capping fees is good enough. Well, it's not good enough. I don't know how that deal came to pass. But please, Minnesota, don't you fall for it, too. The trap is, let's let the monopoly off the hook and do these band-aids in the states, like a price cap, and hope that the monopolist behaves himself. Unless and until Live Nation becomes a regulated utility, that's a fool's errand. Because the reason they support this bill, they being Live Nation Ticketmaster, is they know full well if they can stave off the last vestige of competition in the value chain, then they've got you, the entire value chain, the venues, the promoters, the ticket sale, the ticket resale, they'll have the whole enchilada. So my view is your attorney general is doing the right thing. He's sticking in the fight in court against the monopoly. And the state of Minnesota would be wise, in my view, just to see how that plays out. Because imagine, for example, you pass this bill and then there's a different, better, higher standard that results from that trial. Now, in a way, you've set yourself back. So it's easy to say we have an affordability problem, let's cap the price. I understand where that comes from. Yeah. I just would ask you to look at the bigger picture. Who's calling for this? Who benefits really? And why is Ticketmaster supporting this bill? To me, that's all you need to know. The state of Minnesota knows they're a monopolist, knows they've been abusing their market power. We've beaten the NFL. You can beat Ticketmaster. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Final listed testifier is Sean Chapman. And Mr.
Good morning.
Chapman, can identify Chairman, yourself for Chairman, the record.
Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4250. My name is Sean Chapman. I am a representative of StubHub. To explain why we believe this bill, as currently drafted, would ultimately hurt fans, and we respectfully oppose it. StubHub was founded in 2000. We helped turn ticket resale from something people did on a street corner into something that's safe, transparent, and reliable. Every order is backed by our Fan Protect Guarantee, ensuring fans get into the event or their money back. Unlike others, StubHub does not set the ticket prices. We're a marketplace. Sellers choose their price, and buyers decide what works for their budget. That flexibility often helps fans find affordable options. In fact, nearly 90% of concert tickets sold on StubHub in North America are under $100, and 60% are under $50. While House File 4250 is well-intentioned, the reality is that price controls like this tend to backfire. Instead of protecting consumers, price controls will push ticket sales off of transparent, regulated marketplaces and into unregulated, illicit spaces where fraud is far more likely. The bill caps the price you can sell your ticket at 115% of face. This places a burden on the fan, the platforms to find out what that original face was. It relies on an undefined and outdated concept of face value. In today's ticketing world, where nearly everything is electronic, there is often no single face value. Prices change based on dynamic pricing, pre-sales, season tickets, promotions, and release timing. Two fans sitting next to each other could have paid very different prices for identical seats. As drafted, this law is difficult to understand, comply with, or enforce. This means people such as a parent reselling unused season tickets or a fan helping friends sell tickets could unknowingly violate the law. More fundamentally, price controls and monopoly power constraining supply in all industries do not work. It worked for De Beers. It worked when I was young for Nintendo. It's working for whoever decided we deserve laboo-boos in our lives. Ticketing is no exception. When resale prices are capped, tickets do not become cheaper or easier to get. Instead, sellers move away from regulated marketplaces and into places like social media, private message boards, and online classified sites. Places with no fan protect guarantees, no customer service, and no accountability. That shift directly hurts fans. On regulated platforms, people know what they are buying and are protected if something goes wrong. In unregulated markets, fans can get scammed, lose hundreds of dollars, and have no recourse. This is not just theory. Independent research comparing European countries found ticket fraud rates nearly four times higher in markets with resale price controls. Price controls don't remove demand. They push legitimate resale activity underground where fraud thrives. The U.S. Government Accountability Office reached the same conclusion back in 2018. I'm not that old. 2018, stating that price caps are not effective due largely to the difficulty with enforcement. The report also cites a New York Department of State study that found no clear evidence that price caps improve ticket availability or result in lower prices. Here in Minnesota, more than 200,000 fans used StubHub to buy or sell tickets in 2025, attending more than 4,000 events. House File 4250 would not make tickets more affordable. Instead, it will reduce safe options for these 200,000 fans, increase fraud risk, and create confusion for people selling tickets to an event they can no longer attend. True consumer protection keeps transactions in transparent, regulated marketplaces and respects fans' rights to transfer or resell tickets they have legally purchased. Price controls do the opposite. This is why 8 states have rejected price caps, and in 2024, as you have heard, Massachusetts took the step to repeal that law. We should also note who favors the caps: the dominant integrated company that has actively lobbied for resale caps. When incumbents back a policy that limits market entry or price signals, it's a warning sign the policy will entrench market power, not empower consumers. This does not mean we should not do nothing. There are many ways and considered ways to thoughtfully address these issues. However, this bill does not address the core problem: the supply, the holdbacks, the entrenched monopoly power. For these reasons, StubHub respectfully urges the committee to oppose House File 4250. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. This was the last listed testifier. We've got a list of names for questions here. So if there's no other testifiers, we can move to a discussion of the bill. So we've got Representative Hewitt first, then West, then Dotsis, Kinsella, Cotiza Watoon, and then Reimer. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair, for bringing this bill. I never really liked pricing transparency for a simple fact that they've tried to do this in emergency rooms, and I got to tell you, every time I brought a patient in, they did not want the menu for the price list. And I think that when someone really wants something, that determines the market of what it is. It's like, it's a terrible situation, but it sounds like we're trying to protect the public in this situation. And I don't see why we're just not outlawing the practice altogether. I mean, 15% is a lot of money. As a realtor, I make 2%. So I don't know why 15%, even though it's on $100, you sell thousands of these tickets, it's going to amount to a lot. So I guess I'm kind of held back on here why we're just not outlawing this practice. And if they want to use a ticket broker like a venue, can't they just hire them at a flat fee and let them liquidate their tickets? I'm kind of confused to that fact, because I think we should look at this is definitely protecting the public because they really want this stuff and they want to spend it, but is this going to work? So I turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Chair Cagle, would you like to respond?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am old enough to remember the time before we had resale markets. We used to have a law in the books that was anti-speculative ticket sales. So you were not allowed to sell a ticket for more than face value. And I'm not sure when those laws got repealed, but I'm sure it's when the technology caught up. And so there actually just was a report as well from Senator Blumenthal's office on, and one of the policy recommendations that they found was price caps. And we are taking a two-pronged approach on this. I've spoken with the Attorney General right after the DOJ dropped out of that Ticketmaster case, the AG said that they will not be settling and that they will continue the suit on Ticketmaster and Live Nation so that we are able to break up those monopolies. But we do have a real problem with speculative tickets and the incredible markup that they have. And this is, you know, talk about free markets, this is not a free market. This is a deceptive market that's preying on people. And I heard, you know, that the that, you know, we'd be going in the buying tickets from a guy in the parking lot or in the back alley. Well, what these websites essentially are doing is bringing that guy in the back alley into our living rooms without us even knowing that it is the slimy guy in the back alley. And so this is really about making sure we know what we're buying and that we, that there's transparency and fairness in the markets.
Okay, Representative Hewitt, you're done? Okay. Yep, okay, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So listening to the testifiers and the bill author, this is framed as something that's absolutely terrific and everybody's going to be thrilled. But my question is, well, look, what do you have against Broadway shows and pro sports? Why are they carved out of this bill?
Representative Cagle, would you like to respond?
I'm going to call on the First Avenue. Thank you.
Representative, Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. In short, I think they run very different businesses than we do. They have subscription services and season tickets. They typically feel differently than we do about resale. So it felt the cleanest to separate those out so that folks who are buying season tickets and subscriptions have the ability to resell things in a different way since their industry is very different.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, one of the issues that I've had is I've paid much more than face value for a Vikings game in particular. So this issue does exist beyond that, but I don't believe, I like the disclosure pieces of the bill. I think there's a lot of work that can be done on making sure people know how much the face value of a ticket is. And I wish price caps work, but price caps almost always fail, create shortages, and entrenched players, which you've heard repeatedly about the largest of all organizations that we all loathe. We passed a bill targeting their trade practices, essentially. And there's a lawsuit, as was previously mentioned, against Ticketmaster and Live Nation. This bill talks about going after incentives, but which is the way to do it. We should always try and incentivize good behavior. But as been pointed out by numerous testifiers, you're creating a massive value for people to move to a fraudulent market. If there's only a 15% markup going through somebody, a reputable organization that can sell tickets and verify them, which is a separate issue I think we should look at, you create a situation where somebody can sell on the street, on Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, numerous places at a massive markup and have even greater demand because the tickets aren't available from this price cap. And price caps always lead to shortages. It happens every time. I wasn't alive for it, but the price cap started with gasoline, led to gasoline shortages. We keep seeing that across everywhere where we put in price caps. So I like the spirit of the bill. I think the disclosure is a good idea. But price caps never work as intended. And if they did, we could really solve a lot of problems very easily in the legislature. Okay.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, this is one of the arguments that we hear from a lot of the, you know, I think it's one of the clear talking points that, you know, folks have used. And so, you know, this already is a distorted market. You know, this is the black market. This is the illicit market coming into our living rooms legally. And so that's, you know, I mean, this is just not a good practice. It's not a good look. And this is about fairness. So clear rules, transparency, enforcement. You know, it won't increase, it'll bring more transactions back into a fair and regulated market. You know, you can see the people on the streets who are selling tickets. And so that is, I don't buy that argument. It's also not about controlling prices, it's about preventing exploitation. You know, we already regulate price gouging in emergencies. And this kind of applies that same principle to the market where consumers are routinely misled and overcharged. And so, you know, to have a fair market, there has to be fairness. And right now there's deceptiveness and secrecy around the pricing of these tickets. And it's our job to make sure that we protect Minnesotans from this price gouging.
Okay, Representative West, any follow-up? If not, we'll go to Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cagle, I've got just a few brief questions. First one would be, just for clarification, does this bill cap the prices on tickets for only the secondary market tickets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dotseth, yeah.
It does, okay. Follow-up question would be, does Ticketmaster and your ticket agent access benefit from this bill?
Does Ticketmaster benefit from the bill? I wouldn't know.
I don't think we have anybody from Ticketmaster here.
I just have some concerns with some of the language that's in here. I'm sorry, Chair. Just a final question would be, what other states has this bill actually been implemented?
I don't know if there has been, Mr. Chair and members. I don't know. Has there been any other states?
I believe in Maine, yes.
Maine? And, you know, I'm not afraid of doing things first. I think that's the cool thing about Minnesota is that we kind of tend to lead the way. You know, I had another bill where we put in a policy that was the second in the country, and it's funding roads in our small communities across the state. And so, you know, I think we should be on the leading edge of protecting our consumers. And then we've also seen this in Europe has also enacted these caps as well. I don't know, this just reminds me, there was a soccer team or football team in England that an American owner came and bought and then raised the prices of the tickets like a lot, and the fans went on strike. They refused to pay it, and so they had to bring the prices back down. That's what the power of the people is. And so that's what we're trying to bring back is, you know, making sure that the market is fair and that people have control and that they can drive the demand. They can drive the prices, not this artificial bot that comes up and buys all the tickets and then artificially inflates demand for the product. That is not a fair system. And we are taking a two-pronged approach on this with, the lawsuits against Live Nation and Ticketmaster, as well as making sure that we can regulate the secondary market so we're not getting price gouged.
Just follow up, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Chair Cagle, I appreciate the heart behind this bill. I just ask that if we're leading the way, we want to lead the way properly, make sure we do it right. I think this has a little ways to go before we get there, but I appreciate your heart and your intent behind
it. Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could ask, I'm totally open to suggestions, so I'd love to hear your ideas. You know, I'm willing to do it, I'm willing to do any kind of amendments that you would like if that's in order. So I'm interested in what your suggestion would be.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cortese Watune, and we need to keep moving here because we're running out of time.
So, am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. So I guess, Representative Cagle, I just want to confirm there was one of the online testifiers who works in this industry who was saying that for tonight's Timberwolves game, there are tickets that are priced lower than the face value of the ticket, according to his research. Does anything in this bill prohibit a reseller from lowering the price below face value? Because that's not the way I'm reading the bill.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cortese Watune, no. And we're actually not asking them to put the face value in either. We're asking to disclose the all-in pricing because we know that there's all sorts of little fees and things along the way. And so what we would like disclosed is the all-in pricing against the resale all-in pricing. And so so that there's no tricks or hidden fees or anything like that. But no, definitely somebody could sell their ticket for lower than the all-in price.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Cortese, would you?
Thank you. My next question, I guess, is that I'm seeing in line 4.14, the ticket reseller or online ticket marketplace is prohibited from reselling a ticket. What does that mean for individuals? So they're talking about people selling tickets on Craigslist, on Facebook Marketplace, maybe scalpers standing outside the stadium. I think that all of those things still happen right now. I'm just wondering, does this impact that at all? Or it just people might do a little bit more of that if they aren't prohibited from selling above 115% of the markup on one of these sites.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Cortese Watune, I think I would be more willing to go to the secondary market than on Facebook or Craigslist or whatever it may be, because you know then it's a guaranteed ticket that you're going to be getting what you pay for and you're not going to be getting price gouged. You might find a friend online, you know. When I got to go to the Tom Morello Bruce Springsteen show down at First Avenue, I was like, you know, put a Facebook message out, hey, I'm desperate for a ticket. Does anybody have one? And then a friend messaged me and said, yeah, I got one. You want to come with? So, that's probably still going to happen. But I think as somebody who enjoys going to shows and wants to make sure that I'm actually going to see the artist that I'm that I want to see, I would go to the secondary market.
Do you have a follow-up?
No, I'm done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, because we really need to get to a vote. Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is directed at the last testifier we had from StubHub, if he's still here. Sorry, I forgot your name. If you could just...
Sean Chapman. And do I get the courtesy of a phone a friend or no? That's just for members.
Nope, you are the friend.
I'm the friend.
You are the friend. So, Sean, so it's been kind of bantied about here in the committee that, you know, the 115%, the dramatic cases of jacking up ticket prices, it's even been said that we should consider outlawing your business completely. In just like a minute, could you give me a elevator pitch about what StubHub actually provides? What value do you provide to consumers and to the venues?
Sure. I think both proponents and opponents of the file have both stated how incredibly difficult it is to get that primary ticket. And that's not an accident. There are massive, massive, massive holdbacks. Less than 50% are put out to the general public writ large. What the value is that you actually do get to go. I'm old enough that Pearl Jam was my favorite band.
Great band.
And unfortunately, like so many New Kids on the Block or Backstreet Boys, I wasn't sure, but I didn't get to go to see them because they were persona non grata with the primary for so long. We provide access. We provide ease of use. We provide comfort and position of mind, of peace of mind in that transaction. Am I in the elevator still? And I think the final thing is that this would probably limit greatly the actual secondary marketplaces that are still able to conduct business in this manner, in that place, and in the same way. It just would have a lot of concerns there on that. It's not a matter of would we be there and comply? Of course we would. It just would be, would it be effective? Would it be useful? Would that 200,000 number get greatly reduced? I think that's the big piece.
Okay, Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up question then. Is StubHub or any of your competitors, have you been deemed in the court of law a legal monopoly?
No. Okay. No, I'd love that problem.
Don't say that here.
Okay, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Cagle, for the bill and everyone who testified. I know that we're in a hurry, so I'm happy to vote this forward to Judiciary and reserve my questions for there. But in the meantime, I'll just say this is complicated. I think I support what's going on here, but it is a red flag to me that we received testimony in favor of this bill from Live Nation and Ticketmaster, and they're not here. So if somebody from that company could come to Judiciary Committee, that would be great.
Chair Cagle?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw Joel Carlson here earlier, but I don't see him here anymore. Yeah.
Okay, then, Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cagle, thank you for bringing this idea forward. And as I've contemplated options and ideas on this, I just want to throw some things out for your consideration. As I look at the bill authors on here, there is bipartisan support, but I also noticed another name that jumped out on here, and that's Chair Moeller, and she is the one who carried the bill for the Taylor Swift stuff, and we had bipartisan support on that. And I do believe that this area needs some help in the arena, just like that area did. What we've become as a society right now is that you get your ticket or your access on your phone and it's not transferable. Everybody is talking about their personal history. My personal history, two things. Never been to a concert, so this doesn't affect me.
What? We will bring you to one.
The chair, for the record, transparency, the co-chair has invited me to many concerts and said, we will get you to a concert, and they're a lot of fun. But I digress on that. And then number two, because we don't have the physical ticket anymore, I can't give it to my neighbor. I can't gift it to anybody. And if I want to turn it back in, there's a fee to turn it back in. There's a fee to assign. And I suspect a lot of those things that were in the Taylor Swift bill, as we referred to it as, is the same kinds of situations that we're having here. And Chair Cagle, here is my question for you as the bill author on here. We've had a hearing on this today in our committee. I know we're looking to move it to the Judiciary Committee. I asked the question of you and others, do we compromise litigation that the Attorney General's office is engaged in if we take a position on this bill? Hearing this bill, having this discussion, laying this bill over, I think sends a message and helps to strengthen the conversation that the Attorney General may have in this arena. Putting it to a vote with not knowing where this is going to land may or may not help the case on this. I also notice that there's not a Senate companion, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't deal with that in our committee, but I just don't want to bias this conversation potentially by a vote. I'm going to leave it up to you, but those are just my thoughts that have occurred as I've heard the testimony today, that something like this is going to happen, and it could be through legislation after litigation, or it could be in conjunction with that. We've always in the past, when there's been litigation in the legislature, kind of stepped back from passing laws that would interfere with litigation that the state of Minnesota is engaged in and trying to let that judicial process work its way through. So I don't know where the vote's going to come down on this, but I do just put that out there for your consumption and consideration, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I would observe that, you know, with the bill, if we do move the bill to Judiciary, there's room to discuss it and compromise there as well. Chair Cagle, your thoughts?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I agree that there's work to be done on this. I would appreciate it getting moved to Judiciary because of the fact that then we can address some of those AG issues. I think that's probably the proper place to talk about that. I don't see anybody from the AG's office here today. But, you know, you and I have worked wonderfully together, and I really enjoy the work that we've done. And I think, you know, through our relationship over the past, you know, couple months, we've built some trust. And so I'm hoping that we can move this to Judiciary with the understanding that we can address some of those issues that have been brought up here. You know, we're coming up against deadline, and me and you actually take those seriously. And so I would like to get this through the policy committees, and we do know that the Senate companion is being introduced as well.
Okay, thank you. Chair Cagle, do you have any further closing comments? If not, would you like to renew your motion?
I really hope that, you know, members can support the motion to move it on to Judiciary. I think this is a really important bill for the folks in Minnesota, because we all deserve to have a little fun and go see our favorite bands. And, you know, as a mom, I want to be able to bring my kiddo to concerts. And I just want that same experience to be available to everybody. So with that, I will move House File 4250 to Judiciary, please.
Okay, thank you. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails on your way to Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And with that, I think that's all the business we have before us today. Is there anything else here? Mr. O'Neill. Yeah, members, that's all we have for today. Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to speak about the next meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And given the lateness of the hour here, I will just let you know that we do have an action-packed week next week, as Co-Chair Cagle mentioned. Next week is our last week. So there are going to be a number of bills, of things that we maybe have talked about, laid over, things that we're working on, and again, trying to, in a bipartisan fashion, lead the way again in the Minnesota House, as we did last year with Commerce, doing the work of the people and getting good product out. So with that, Mr. Chair, I wish everyone a good weekend.
And with that, we are adjourned.